In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Welcome to another episode of Strange Planet. Thanks for sticking me in your ear. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, homeopathy was popular across all classes of society. In the United States, there were more than 100 homeopathic hospitals, more than 1,000 homeopathic pharmacies, and 22 homeopathic medical schools. In particular, homeopathic psychiatry flourished from the 1870s to the 1930s, with thousands of documented successful outcomes in treating mental illness. And we're going to talk about sane asylums, the success of homeopathy before psychiatry lost its mind. That's the title of a brand new book by Jerry M. Cantor. Jerry is a faculty member of the Ontario College of Homeopathic Medicine and owner of Vital Force Healthcare, a Boston area homeopathy and acupuncture practice, the first acupuncturist to receive an academic appointment at Harvard Medical School's Department of Anesthesiology. And Jerry is the author of also Interpreting Chronic Illness, The Toxic Relationship Cure, and Autism Reversal Toolbox. And he joins us from his home in Dedham, Massachusetts. Jerry, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm really fine. Pleasure to be with you, Richard.
Likewise. Can you give us a definition? What is homeopathy or homeopathic medicine?
Well, this is the way of practicing according to the principle of using like to cure like. And again, because there's been so much disinformation and mischaracterization, people tend to think that homeopathy is synonymous with anything holistic, a word that starts with H, herbs, another word that starts with H, anything gentle, Not true, not true, not true. Homeopathy means one thing and one thing only, the law of similars, using like to cure like. So homeo means same as, apathy relates to sickness. Like to cure like, that means when a homeopath meets you, the idea is to get to know you really, really well and understand your total symptom picture and be able to match that with the toxic effect of some kind of a substance, which can be a botanical, can be of the venom of a snake or a spider or something. It could be a mineral compound. It could be a gas. Something that we homeopaths have researched very extensively under highly scientific conditions, and inculcating a certain state in random healthy people with mental and emotional characteristics, so that we can then once that is compiled and put into the Materia Medica, the matching game begins. Someone comes into my office and I say to myself, huh, it's as if this was a random person who was poisoned by lead, or this is a person who was poisoned by a plant called Staphysagria. Of course, that's not necessarily true, but the matching is correct because we know exactly what the influence of that substance is on healthy individuals. So I'm going to give you a long answer here.
No, this is good stuff.
Giving the dilute version of that, the dilute version of that substance, you then can count on a paradoxical effect. What it caused in a gross amount, it cures in a dilute amount. And, you know, when I was in junior high school, a teacher said something very interesting to me, which I stored away, said any definition of life must include the property of irritability. What that means is that you poke it and it reacts. Kind of simple, but and I thought it was funny when I was in junior high school, but it's really true. So I'm an acupuncturist, right? And acupuncture is a poking. It's a mini, 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 mini stabbing. And homeopathy is a poking. It's a mini, 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 mini poisoning. Now, how you poke and what you expect are two different things. Yes, if you, of course, stab somebody with a knife, that's not good. But the mini version of that, the acupuncture needle, is a wonderful thing because you're exploiting the body's irritability. And with homeopathy, obviously, you don't want to poison anybody with arsenic. But the highly dilute version of arsenic, arsenicum, that pokes a certain kind of individual who's highly anxious, for example, and perfectionistic and has all kinds of digestive problems. That person poked with my dilute version of arsenic receives a healing dose. I would say that the remedy, so many metaphors that apply to this, is like a permission slip to the subconscious, which is the vital force imbued with its physical characteristics, to deal with an issue that it has not done everything in its power to avoid or to suppress. The vital force encounters this substance, which includes this theme, and it says, oh my God, I hate that. That's horrible. What the hell is that? But wait a minute. There's hardly any of it here. Huh, okay, I guess I'll deal with this. So another way of putting this is that homeopathy at the constitutional level prompts the vital force, or prompts the subconscious of the individual to revisit the scene of the crime, re-engage with your demon, re-engage with your trauma under more favorable circumstances. It releases, and in doing so, it releases prompts a reaction that actually wants to happen, but has not been able to happen because the impetus has been so consistent or so traumatic that the vital force has not been able to deal with it and has sort of covered it up. So when with remedies, we're peeling one layer away at a time when we give one remedy at a time, and this is how somebody gets healthy. I've told you quite a bit there, but
I'll
give you one more metaphor to really simplify this because it's really advanced placement common sense. Sometimes I'll tell people about the expression to get back on the horse that threw you. What does that mean? You know, well, it means, especially in a culture where riding a horse is a matter of life and death, where everything depends on it. If you're thrown by a horse and you're terrified of ever getting on one again, that could be a really bad thing. Well, you may not want to get back on the same crazy horse that threw you, but maybe a junior version like a pony. So now you're up on that pony's back and you say, oh my God, I'm on a horse again. This is horrible. Something terrible is going to happen. And then you get led around the corral gently and you say, wait, nothing's happening here. Nothing's happening. And by the time the little ride is over, you get off the pony and you say, you know, I guess it wasn't all horses. Maybe it was just that one horse. I'm back to baseline. So that's a way of achieving homeostasis. Homeopathy is something like that, except rather than just getting back to homeostasis, The remedy is like a bomb placed deep in the subconscious, and it's so specific that when it goes off, the entire internal landscape is changed, and when the smoke clears and the dust settles, you are in a different place. You are not that same person who was traumatized by being abused or bullied or having had a devastating loss or some terrible injury. The remedy was so specifically tailored to you that you overcome it. You revisit the crime, as I say, under more favorable circumstances. And the simplest version of comparison is getting back on the horse that threw you.
I mean, this seems almost obvious.
Yes.
So why is it so homeopathy becomes so controversial?
Oh, completely for economic reasons. Completely for economic reasons. And that's, if you read my book, Sane Asylums, you'll get a big picture understanding of that. Why this wonderful medicine, which is the remedies are not patented. Nobody owns them. So the profit motive doesn't work. They just simply work, but they're not going to make a lot of money for a pharmaceutical company. So it was very important to the medical profession and the pharmaceutical industry to suppress knowledge of this. I'm really simplifying things because it happened over a period of time. It's just way too threatening. Just like acupuncture was really fought tooth and nail originally because, my God, if people went to acupuncture for their pain, who's going to buy pain medicines? You know, and acupuncture succeeded because it simply works. And, you know, when I started out, we had to practice secretly. We were called voodoo doctors and made fun of all over the place. Now people come out of Ivy League schools and they become acupuncturists and it's licensed in every single state. No thanks to the medical profession or to science. Absolutely nothing. All their research was completely trivial and useless, but people voted with their feet and they went for it because they knew it worked. Homeopathy will also never go away for the same reason. But a huge effort has been made, I have to say, writing this book. I couldn't believe how much suppression there was. The story of these amazing homeopathic utopian mental hospitals was eradicated, actually whitewashed from the medical history books. The story of and the websites that were of the hospitals that were homeopathic and the medical schools that were homeopathic, you won't find any mention of this. There's a tremendous attempt to paint this homeopathy as a sect or some kind of a heresy. Nothing could be further from the truth. It had a tremendous presence. There's a lot to hide because it's just so darn threatening. This is the first book to come out in quite some time that's, you know, an honest depiction of the homeopathic history. And it's also one of the very rare books that's written by a homeopath. So you could, you know, not somebody who's got an axe to grind coming out of what's that medical school down in Baltimore that puts out these history books that are really so false.
Johns Hopkins.
Yeah. Their books, they're the ones that will portray it as a sect or a heresy, complete nonsense. So yeah, I'm hoping that the waters break and more books like this come out because it's really quite a rabbit hole I fell down into and a tremendous amount of information of tremendous interest. For example, Mary Todd Lincoln.
Yes.
150 years now. I mean, that story seems to have been completely picked over. Even though Lincoln scholarship is really very extensive, no one's told the story that I uncovered that Mary Todd Lincoln, who was declared incurably insane by a trial with 14 doctors, it was the trial of the century, basically. I have a very powerful case that she was cured over a period of 4 months in what I call a sane asylum, you know, by somebody practicing homeopathy. It's a very strong case for that. That story's not been told, so it's a 150-year-old literary journalistic coup that I hope gets read.
I want to come back to Mary Todd Lincoln in that specific case, but I just wanted to back up a minute. I had a conversation recently with someone who wrote a book about the, I guess they called them the monastic mediciners that accompanied the chivalric orders during the Crusades. So these were their doctors and their surgeons. They were called monastic mediciners. And when you said like treats like, that sounds very familiar because he used that same language. So I'm just wondering, you know, these monastic mediciners, whether they likely were also utilizing homeopathic medicine, or in other words, how far back does this practice go?
Oh, it goes back to Paracelsus. Anything true has always been known on some level. Just certain cultures really went very far with it. Yeah, Paracelsus taught this. It's also in Chinese medicine to some extent. It's as old as the idea of get back on the horse that threw you. We know we have to face our demons. So I'm not surprised it's been it's in other cultures. But every once in a while, someone really goes wild with an idea. I mean, rubbing something that hurts on your body, you know, rubbing it or strong massage, that exists everywhere. Everybody knows that. But the Chinese really decided, how far can we take this idea? What are these places that we're rubbing? You know, can we also rub places or stimulate places that are not proximal to where the injury is? And it took 5,000, over 5,000 years of really concentrating on this. They developed this amazing system of Chinese medicine, and discovered the meridian system. So the principles are old, and the law of similars is simply a law of nature. By the way, that's why homeopathic remedies have an unusual stature. People don't know this. There's so much misinformation. They are drugs. The FDA said so in 1938, even before. They are drugs because the law of similars was recognized as being a law of nature, absolutely true. That means you don't have to put every single remedy through the process of a randomized controlled trial to see if it works. You don't have to, because the law of similars works. It always has. So anything that's gone through homeopathic research called approving, in other words, showing what it does to healthy people, automatically, the FDA said this, doesn't like to admit it anymore, that the dilute version of that can be used to treat somebody who manifests that symptom complex.
So take us back to the late 1800s, when there were over 100 homeopathic hospitals across the United States. I mean, where were they? What did they look like? How did they operate?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. In that era, before the pharmaceuticals came along, there was a lot of overlap between conventional medicine and homeopathy. Everybody was using basically the same things and using different amounts of that stuff. But people who were trained by homeopaths and were disciples of Hahnemann, and by the way, those were many of those homeopaths were physicians who converted. They recognized that their own medicine stunk and they were harming clients, and then they would find that the homeopathic treatment would work miracles, and they converted. There are probably more convert physicians than people who went directly into the homeopathic practice. A lot of places were practicing a mixture. They wouldn't admit that they were specifically homeopathic or not. And I have lots of instances of that. In fact, that's what happened with Mary Todd Lincoln. The person who treated her did not officially declare himself a homeopath, but he kept no records. And supposedly all he practiced was moral care. And the homeopaths who referred Mary Todd Lincoln to him, like Stanton, it was all wink, wink. We know what you're doing. You've got a secret weapon. You know, hand-holding and respecting somebody and giving them activities cannot cure madness. It's impossible. How would you get a reputation like that without having that secret weapon? And that might have been circumstantial. It's more than that. But for example, the Butler Hospital, which was not officially homeopathic and had a fantastically stellar reputation for treating madness, it had a secret weapon that's absolutely incontrovertible, which was Samuel Worcester, who was a major homeopath, wrote a very big book on the homeopathic treatment of madness. So it was an unclear situation. There was a lot of overlap. People would poach from each other all the time. Conventional physicians would find that on their own, that some dilute version of a medicine worked much better. And they thought they invented the whole thing each time, over and over again, never giving credit to the homeopaths. There was a physician by the name of David Dice Brown who kind of called out at some point, called time out, and said, "Hey, come on, guys, who are you kidding?" And he wrote this book called The Permeation of Modern Day Medicine by Homeopathy, pointing out, you know, look at this. You guys are doing homeopathy left and right. You're just not admitting it. Come on, cut it out. You know, but anyway, physicians like to have control over the amount of something they gave. And it was kind of known that it was a very different thing to give a gross amount as opposed to a minor amount. And you get a very different effect. But the political rivalry between the schools was still very intense, primarily because homeopaths were so good and so popular, they were making a lot of money and they were eating the conventional physician's lunch. And the doctors complained, "Yeah, this is not fair. I have all this education. Everybody's going to the homeopath." And that's why the AMA was created. Another story that's been been severely, you know, securely battened down that people, so people don't know it.
1,000 homeopathic pharmacies. So give us a sense, like, what would you find back then in a homeopathic pharmacy?
Oh, by the way, in those days, they were called dispensaries too. You could go there and get treated. It was not that political distinction between a pharmacist and a physician. Well, the pharmacist would have had what I have, an armamentarium of remedies, hundreds and hundreds of remedies made from all these things. And they would have some books there, Homeopathic Materia Medica. And they'd be in little vials, these remedies, and you'd go there and be prescribed for. You'd go there with a condition, and the homeopath would look at you, ask you a bunch of questions. If someone brought you because you were so sick, he or she would do the same thing, you know, examine you, look at your face, assign, you know, figure out whether you chilled or not. Look very carefully at your symptoms, take an inventory of them, and prescribe basically using the mental and the emotional picture as the guiding principle. So when you're sick, you're not a car. You're not just the sum of all these physical complaints. How you are when you're sick matters a great, great deal to homeopaths. We don't send you to the psychiatrist because we don't understand what you're talking about. If you're raving, if you're complaining, if you're crying, if you don't want to talk, if you're weeping or if you can't weep, if you're jumpy, if you're restless, all these things would be taken note of and, you know, very careful note of and be guiding principles to the accurate prescription. Because any physical symptom that you can think of, a cough or a diarrhea or constipation, there are hundreds and hundreds of remedies that treat that. To narrow it down, we have to figure out what kind of soil that symptom grew in. And that has a lot to do with what the person's like. When I take someone's case, Richard, the most important question I ask, if they're not an animal or an infant, is what is your hot button? What's the situation you least like to be in? What will get an emotional response out of you? And when that button is pushed, what do? Do you get drunk? Do you get irritable? Do you get angry? Do you withdraw? Do you write a poem? That's a huge amount of information in that one particular question. If I have to go deep into your life, I'll ask a brutal question like, what's the worst thing that ever happened to you? I might also ask more cheerful questions like, how are you famous in your family? What stories were told about you as a child? So we can prescribe in homeopathy based on a person's strengths as well as weaknesses. We get the whole picture. We don't break you down into parts.
That's remarkable. Jerry, we'll take a quick time out. We'll come back and continue to discuss homeopathy and sane asylums, the success of homeopathy before psychiatry lost its mind.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
We're back with Jerry M. Cantor, the author of Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind. Were they actually called sane asylums?
No, they weren't. They were called, lingo was completely different. That's my term for it, because they were utopias and they really were a very sane way of helping the mentally ill who had problems of life. They were not, you know, psychotics and schizophrenics, and they were viewed as people who had run into some trouble and lost their reason, lost their orientation. And the people who worked there, especially the nurses, fought tooth and nail with the idea of moral hygiene to get people to get their own balance. The idea was not to drug them and send them into the community again, where they would just get by as zombies. People were very committed, and they took the time, you know, to do this. The people were given actual asylum. They could stay there a long time and engage in activities like farming and playing musical instruments and writing. They were taken away from their stressful environments. They were allowed to rest. They were given good diets. They had fresh air. And of course, they had the benefit of these amazing homeopathic remedies.
Okay, so let's talk about some of these remedies. I don't know if someone was catatonic or, how would they go about, you know, determining what the actual remedy would be? And can you give me some examples of remedies?
Oh my God, how much time do you have? Well, again, we don't prescribe based on any one symptom. There could be six people who are catatonic and they'll be there for very different reasons. In those days, it might well have been the advanced stages of alcoholism. It might have been a third stage of syphilis, catatonia, paresis. I mean, they had different lingo at that point. So by the time people got there, they had pretty advanced cases. Give me another condition. That one I'd have
How
to go.
How about depression?
Through. Oh, depression. Depression. Sure, depression. Well, you could, if someone was deeply depressed and apathetic, and also the physical symptoms would be bloating, and suddenly would come in, like a woman would come and say she didn't love her husband anymore, and she just didn't have anything to live for. That might be sepia, a remedy made from the ink of the cuttlefish. So the metaphor there is that it muddies the waters. The ink, the cuttlefish squirts this ink into the water, and then as a defense, you can't see it, but it can't see where it is either. When someone needs the remedy sepia, her life is kind of, waters are muddied. She doesn't quite know where she is in life. Her husband may be stepping out on her. She just doesn't know. Well, one of the gates would be with women, you know, marriage or pregnancy or menopause. Any of those stages may not have gone well for her and confused her as to her psychosexual identity. And you hope in that situation, hope becomes toxic. This is somebody who's basically a natural woman. She's invested in the future. She loves to dance. Things should go in a certain way as they should. But disappointment has kind of dragged her down, and her psyche is trying to have it both ways. Wants to be optimistic, but also knows something's going wrong. And so everything has a half-hearted quality to it. And you see how specific this gets. That's a certain kind of depression. And sepia, when it's prescribed, will allow her to overthrow that state. When she comes out of it, she may be angry or she may be sad, but she's going to have a much clearer idea of where she is. And she'll be able to do something that she couldn't do before. That's one example of, I mean, these terms like depression are just very, very inadequate, much more specific. Is the remedy itself. So the remedy is the diagnosis and the remedy is the treatment. If someone is just crying all the time and she feels abandoned and all she wants to, you know, she cries at the drop of a hat and she's very, very changeable, likely her trauma has been abandonment or fear of abandonment. And then the remedy pulsatilla comes into play.
Pulsatilla, what is that?
It's made from the wind flower. These are flower remedies that I'm mentioning to you. Depression remedies. Natrum muriaticum is made from sodium chloride, which is simply table salt. That's a major remedy for somebody who has been stuck in grief. They cannot get over a particular grief. These are people who say they can't cry. They've lost somebody really important, and they just can't cry. Or if they cry, they resist consolation, and they will only do it in private. And part of that picture is that it can affect your vision. People can have blurred vision. You can have nausea, all kinds of digestive problems, but also some innocuous types of symptoms that the homeopath will notice. They'll have very practical hairstyles. They have a very serious kind of pinched look to their face. There might be nurses. because they want their cake and eat it too. They want to have intimacy, but they also keep it at arm's length. They have been hurt by the fact that they were very close to someone, often their mother, and then the loss of that relationship has made them very self-contained. They're like a country that sends all its resources to the periphery, and it looks from the outside, looks like it's got it all together, but the inside is tender and weak, and you don't realize the price that's been paid. That's a classical grief remedy. And when you give that, it kind of explodes the grief. They become more in contact with it. They become more emotive, but they move through that. So yeah, these remedies, I mean, they're amazing. I mean, because they go so deeply into someone's character, their psyche. I do want to say the problem with conventional psychiatry, why I say it's lost its mind, it's also lost its soul, is because, of course, it's all driven by money. And the goddamn drugs make people sick. We as a highly developed country, we have terrible health, mental health care statistics. Read the books of Robert Whittaker. They're a shock. Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic. Developing countries which have not been treated by the tender mercies of our psychiatric profession have far, far better mental health statistics than we have. They've been conditions like tardive dyskinesia, the five kinds of bipolarity that we talk about, the kinds of anxiety that's prevalent in this country. It's a crime, frankly. It's been perpetrated on the public. Part of it is just this pushing of these powerful medications on people. And the other part is this tremendous effort to marginalize homeopathy, which is far, far better as a kind of medicine. And I'll beat that drum for a long time. And I think the facts speak for themselves.
All right, I'm going to take another time out. Then I want to get back to Mary Todd Lincoln and talk a little more detail about that case. Jerry Cantor stays with us, the author of Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Every Town podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. We give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Everytown podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you, now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinky County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
The truth will set you free. Free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
So let's get back to Mary Todd Lincoln. She was basically certified as insane. Yes. When did this happen? This episode of insanity, so-called, was this before Abraham Lincoln was president or after?
No, after he was assassinated, but everything kind of came to a head. She was in trouble for quite some time. I mean, she lost two children. She was also a pariah in Washington because she was from the South. Her family actually were slaveholders. She never felt comfortable there. And she attracted the trolls of that time. There was someone who went after her, just awful, saying that Abraham Lincoln never loved her. He had someone else he loved much, much more. She was a consolation prize. Yeah, and she went stark raving mad. I mean, in terms of having hallucinating and the visions that she had and spending a tremendous amount of money. And her son, Robert, basically said, she's really harming herself. We've got to do something about this. And so he pushed the issue, and a trial was held to determine her sanity. Everybody came, 14 doctors and many, many witnesses came through testifying to how out of control she was. She was deeply in grief. So many theories have come up about it since that time, that she had syphilis, that she had dysentery, cholera, I don't know, all kinds of things. And she got sent to this asylum in this little sanitarium in Bellevue, Illinois, which was run by a man called Richard Patterson, who, as I say, was a shrewd cookie. He didn't really say what he did. He kept them kept things very private. But homeopaths referred her there. And within 4 months, she's sitting on the porch talking to Patterson's daughter and writing letters and conversing and going on carriage rides. And then some lawyers contacted her, or she was able to contact the lawyers, and they got her out. And a couple of months later, she was declared as sane as anybody else. The story that I'm telling, that Richard Patterson did something there, that's not been told. The two stories that have been told, neither of them makes any sense at all. One is that she was never crazy in the first place. That's not true. That's simply not true. And the other was, she just had clever lawyers, and somehow she got better on her own. That doesn't make any sense either.
So what is the real story?
The real story is that Patterson, I mean, he didn't keep records, but the Bellevue Asylum that he had arose at exactly the time that the Middletown Hospital in New York arose. Homeopathy was completely at its zenith. And he would have known exactly what she needed. He would have been able to detox her from chloral hydrate. He would have, I could speculate as to the remedies that he gave her. I don't know. He didn't do that. As I say, this was to his advantage, incredible advantage. He didn't want to lose all his standing. And he didn't talk about what he did, which is very interesting. I think he treated her homeopathically. I'm quite certain of it. To the extent to which I do know, what was said about him, and again, this is all code, they said he used the popular medicines of his time. That could mean nothing but homeopathy, because nothing in the conventional armamentarium could have accomplished what he could have done what he did.
Can you speculate as to maybe what some of those remedies might have been? I mean, if you were presented with a case.
Yeah, actually, I have that. I have that in my chapter. Let's see what I have here. I can read you the end of it.
Yes.
but you'd have. So some of this is for homeopaths, of course. Okay, so here's the last paragraph of my chapter on Mary Todd Lincoln. What homeopathic drugs might Dr. Patterson have selected? Prescribing from a distance is speculative, yet cursory inspection of Mrs. Lincoln's case suggests the appropriateness of rubrics. So these are rubrics symptoms that are connected with certain symptoms that are connected with remedies. Okay, so what are the rubrics? Avarice, squanders money, ailments from grief, humiliation, mortification, ailments from fear, sleeplessness, and hysteria. So if a homeopath puts those types of symptoms into his or her homeopathic program, various remedies would come up. And then you have to sort of kick their tires and see which one is most appropriate. Well, what that would bring up, not this will mean anything to you, but the remedies that I came up were clematis, kaffia, hyoscyamus, ignatia, Lachesis, Mercurius, Nux Vomica, Opium, Pulsatilla, which I mentioned before, Sepia, and Syphilinum. What was actually recommended remains a mystery, and perhaps will be revealed in further findings of what I call the homeopathic Dead Sea Scrolls. But if you were a homeopath, I could explain my reasoning behind each of those remedies.
Administering a remedy that involves sepia, for example. You said that comes from a cuttlefish?
Yes.
How, I mean, what would have gone through someone's mind to make that connection that I'm going to take the ink from a cuttlefish to cure depression? How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. That's a fantastic question. You know, if the entire materia medica of homeopathy vanished overnight, of thousands of remedies, we could start all over again with entirely new remedies, you know, and going through the process. I don't know how sepia was selected. Many of the other remedies were made from the existing medicines like arsenic and belladonna and borax. These were all remedies, medicines that were used by the conventional medical professionals. And often they caused so much harm that homeopaths said, oh my God, I've got to clean that up, and made a dilute version of it principally to clean it up. Mercury is a prime example of that. Mercury was found to suppress the symptoms of syphilis, which was rampant. And this is a good story here, actually. But people got scared of doctors because they were constantly using mercury off indication, and people were going nuts. They became mad as hatters. And so people got very afraid of the physicians who were using mercury. Now, the other word for mercury is quicksilver. And so these doctors were called quickers, and then quicks, and then quacks. Uh-huh. The physicians were called that. And the homeopaths had to clean up the mess, and they made the dilutions of mercury to treat that. And then very ironically and unjustly, homeopaths get called quacks now. It's completely the inverse. But things like sepia, you know, many things in the natural, in the, herbs, there were many herbs that were converted to homeopathic remedies. I don't know about sepia, why that happens. Someone had a brainstorm about it and made that amazing remedy. Samuel Hahnemann himself, who had a huge family, the founder of homeopathy, as I understand it, he woke up one morning and said, you know, I'm going to get some potassium and cook it up and feed it to everybody in my family. And he did. He had some insight about it. And that was the proving of a remedy called causticum, which is a fantastic remedy with a huge, huge application. People who need causticum are champions of the underdog. And they're tree huggers, and they're incredibly empathic. And they get their anxiety, very, very anxious, because they're constantly worried that something is going to happen to somebody who's in a vulnerable position. And at the physical level, that includes, they will also manifest all kinds of respiratory problems. They will eventually become paralyzed by their empathy, tendency to become spasmodic. Anyway, why on earth did Hahnemann wake up and decide to do that? I have no idea.
I'm a huge baseball fan, so you have to tell me about the story behind the Asylum's baseball team.
Yeah, that's a great story. That's what got me down this in the first place. I was thinking about writing and doing something impossible, which was writing a history of the homeopathic hospitals. There are hundreds and hundreds of them. So that was a non-starter. And then somehow I stumbled on this amazing story about a baseball team that was sponsored by a mental hospital, and the team was called the Asylums. So what the heck? And Middletown Hospital in New York, that's where it began. Selden Talcott realized that the inmates loved watching baseball. They were completely enraptured by it, and it was much better during watching the games and afterwards. Initially, too, at the baseball field there, the staff and the inmates played together. But he created a monster team that was just fantastic. It included Jack Chesbro, who went to the Hall of Fame later on. They played everybody. They beat everybody. They lost very narrowly to some major league teams.
Wow.
It's just a great, great story. As a contrast to that, baseball took off. He set a trend at the other hospitals, homeopathic or non-homeopathic. And a lot of asylums had baseball teams. In Utica, which was a notorious mental hospital, not homeopathic, where they had a horrible device called the Utica crib, basically a little coffin-sized tiger cage where they'd put you in to punish you, to break your spirit and pacify you. In Utica, a minor league team was created, which was called the Pent-Ups. I find that hysterical, but that was a nod to that hospital there. My fantasy is I ever write a TV series about this, that the Pent-Ups and the Asylums would have played a game, but they were not in the same league. They didn't do that. But although the Pent-Ups, the Asylums, I think actually did get some players from the Pent-Ups eventually. So the baseball story is just absolutely amazing. And I wrote a big chapter in this book on, or where I just really extend Seldon Talcott's argument into all the ways in which baseball is incredibly therapeutic because of the ways in which it replicates ordinary life situations. And there's many, many reasons why it's the most therapeutic sport that you can think of.
I've always felt that intuitively, but I've never been able to put my handle on why. I mean, you know, it's supposed to be a baseball. You go to see the sport played in a park. You know, there's no set time frame. You know, it's not like a 4-hour game. It can go on forever.
It's a lot like life in so many ways. I mean, I could talk about that chapter all day, but I mean, basically, you know, not much goes on in everyday life, right? And only once in a while you got to do something. Baseball the same way. A lot of times the players are standing around scratching or, you know, chewing gum or just, you know, bantering. And then all of a sudden at one point they have to become very alert and jump into action. Or also a lot of the things that you do in a game, even at major league level, maybe you or I could do, catch a pop fly, maybe throw a ground ball. If you hit a home run, you don't have to run hard, just trot around the bases. And then the fact that so many things you cut slack for. You can run outside of the foul lines. You can catch a home run and tumble into the stands. It's a very human game, and it can, you know, just like a human lifespan can be like 2 months or it can be 104 years. A baseball game can go any length. It can you know, go on forever. There's many, many things. Plus the fact, all the idiosyncrasies of the games, all the crazy nicknames. It's politically incorrect to call people these things, but in baseball, you can make fun of somebody because of their build, their proclivities, their religion. I mean, a lot of things are possible. It's just a fantastically ritualistic, meaningful and powerful game.
I'm wondering if Ken Kesey was aware of the Asylum's baseball team because, of course, in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, there's that great scene, Jack Nicholson playing Randall P. Murphy, who's in an asylum, and he tells the nurse, "I just want to watch the damn World Series."
Oh, my God. I forgot about that. That's right. He may not have consciously been aware of it. I mean, very few people, 150 years later, know anything about this. If you go to the middle hospital now, this is disgraceful, but it's one of the few places they'll leave the word homeopathy around to create an association between the horrors that took place much, much later, you know, in places like that when overcrowding took them over. It's now a place you go for a Halloween thrill. And the early history of it, when it was a magnificent utopia, self-sustaining farm, you know, full of idealism, that doesn't come across at all. It's so awful.
Are there any sane asylums left?
Oh, not in this country, I'm afraid. I mean, people like me practice. We always fantasize about it. I have a fever dream at the end of the book where I absolutely fantasize about getting one of these places again. There's a big building in my neighborhood in Natick called Elm Bank, which has been a monastery. It's been a school. It's now like a horticultural institute. It's on beautiful grounds. It would be perfect. We need a place where we can treat our really seriously ill people who have to be seen on a 24-hour basis, who are addicted to medicines. The job is too big to be done entirely on an outpatient basis. All of us homeopaths fantasize about that. We would love to have it come back. If I created one, that's my fever dream at the end of the book. There would be there'd be acupuncturists there, talented therapists, neurobiofeedback people, skilled therapists. I would have a baseball franchise called the Juggernauts. I would bring there. And of course, fantastic nurses like Clara Barris to be the caretakers. We would love to have it come back, but it's a fantasy like having the Dodgers come back to Brooklyn.
Right. Was there a concerted effort to close all of the homeopathic pharmacies and medical schools down? I mean, and were the Rockefellers involved?
Yes, you've got it right, Richard. Absolutely. Carnegie and Rockefeller conspired to create this Flexner report because they wanted to clear the field for their petrochemical patentable drugs. And they succeeded in this bogus campaign against the curriculum of all these schools. They killed Thompsonianism too. And it was an amazingly successful thing. Yeah. They didn't, did they close? I mean, what happened was, it's a complicated history, and I have a chapter in my book called The Concessions to the Spirit of the Times. They didn't just close and be replaced. They gradually lost their identity, and they remained homeopathic in name only. And the homeopaths, you just couldn't resist it at some point, bit by bit. It was very difficult to remain a school purely on homeopathic terms. They did start bringing in surgeons. They brought in people who did a lot of conventional research. To a large extent, they continued treating homeopathically. Then they couldn't do it anymore, and too much money went into the biomedical research. Their demise was self-inflicted in that they brought conventional physicians onto their faculties. It would be like if the Democratic Party invited all the Republicans into their platform, you know, and said, we'll have a unified platform here, and the Republicans took it over, the Democratic Party would vanish, or vice versa. That's the problem with homeopathy. Every time they made a concession or some kind of compromise, it didn't work out well. And now you really see that now, because there are so many people claim, oh yeah, you know, they throw some homeopathic remedies into their naturopathic prescriptions, or they claim they're doing homeopathy when none of it is. It's so confusing. You just don't see any pure homeopathy at the large level that it was in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s. Just not happening. Although people like myself practicing under the radar, yeah, that's where you will see it. But we would love to have the option of hospitalizing somebody at what I would call a sane asylum, where there would be no rush to get them into the community. We would not be drugging them to beds. We would be engaging in moral hygiene, getting them to find their wherewithal by constant dialogue and encouragement and activities. It could be done. There's no reason why it couldn't, except the power of money and the psychopharmacological industry won't have let that happen.
Sane Asylums, the success of homeopathy before psychiatry lost its mind. Jerry, how do we get a copy?
Oh, okay. You can get it at Amazon.com. Just Google Sane Asylums, Jerry Cantor. If you put add to that Simon & Schuster, the book is distributed by Simon & Schuster. If you put in Inner Traditions, Sane Asylums, it'll come up there. If you go to Dana Ullman's site, Homeopathic Educational Services, you can get it there. I was so glad to get a mainstream publisher, because now we will get into libraries, which is an incredible breakthrough. If you do get it, and please review it at Amazon.com, tell other people. It's very important if we really want to make a change in this horrible mental health environment that we have, that it breaks into the mainstream. And I would say that, you know, you can argue with homeopathy on scientific grounds. You shouldn't, because you lose, or ideological grounds. Okay. But for God's sakes, the history exists. You know, you're entitled to know about it. It's a crime that these famous medical books, histories of asylums in this country and medical care, of hospitals and mental health care, that they whitewash this, that they censor this. Is that the kind of country you want to live in? This is not the Soviet Union. You should be entitled to at least have the facts in front of you. So I did a lot of digging to get this out. And people should just, you know, learn how things got to where they are. It was not written in stone that we would be subject to these kinds of drugs that have a numbing and detrimental effect on us at every level, mentally, emotionally, and physically. I would rather not have to detox people from the damn drugs that I've got to treat just to get them back to baseline. It makes my work a lot harder.
Jerry, fantastic speaking with you. I learned a lot. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. You're a great interviewer, and I really enjoyed this show.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.